And the topic of the last section is corticocortical connectivity, especially how corticocortical connectivity can be applied in the study of language. So this is sort of akin to the view that many different measures can be applied, and also that if you want to study naturalistic experiments, the classical evoked responses are not optimal. So then other approaches are used. Actually, this is actually a study where we had a reading task with like rapid serial visual presentation of words, connected text about individual words, or words forming continuous, complete sentences and a continuous story. And these were presented at certain rates. Of course, we first tried to see if this would induce like oscillatory activity at the frequencies. Actually, the oscillatory activity at the known these frequencies was limited to like primary visual regions. So we didn't really see any like language effects. And we took the view that we use corticocortical connectivity, coherence between cortical regions. The picture was quite different. Actually, then using this kind of approach, we started to see interesting things. First of all, we saw that for this kind of sentences and complete story, rapid serial visual presence of words, we see so increased corticocortical connectivity interactions across a wide range of regions. And these actually covered known language regions like the visual processing regions, the word form area, and the registering region, temporal regions where language processing is known to happen, and also more like inferior frontal regions, you know, more computer processing related regions. Moreover, for this reading task, this also is that the interactions within this network for subcomponents of them was increased, further increased, the faster the word rate was. And moreover, if you look at this kind of causality measures, where is the information flowing from, this is that for this network that we had identified, the interactions were primarily like feed forward, originating from the like visual regions and progressing towards the higher order regions, but we didn't really see any, we didn't see prominent feedback connections. So for this kind of rapid serial visual presentation of words, it seems to be that the driving force within the network interaction is the like input streams and their processing. But that was like a continuous naturalistic task, but of course connectivity can be also applied in a similar manner as say this kind of evoked response analysis for really specific events. And there's sort of like an interesting phenomenon in neuroscience is that primary related phenomena, so that if you have something that is really expected in cognitive domain and language domain, it's called, can be called semantic and phonological priming. So if you have like word lists phonologically related, you know, like for example medal, memo, melon, mecca, or in the semantic list peso, dinara, ruble, lira, so there you get it's going to increased expectation, and then as we progress along the word lists or sentences, the amount of neural activity gets reduced as we progress. So in the sense that you require less neural processing process the subsequent words within the list. Actually, there's a lots of literature on what happens then if you break this expectation, but here we wanted to focus on this. What is the sort of driving force that if you require less neural resources, our hypothesis was that that is because your let's say language network is working more efficiently, that there's an increased or more efficient neural interactions within this network. Actually, our hypothesis held. So that for the phonological processing, what we saw is that this is sort of like the region where the phase lock activity is modulated. And we tried to identify regions where the cortico-cortical interactions between this region and other regions is modulated. We saw that in this case for the word third list and word compared to second, there was increased interaction between these for the phonological lists. And for the semantic lists, the same third interactions, corticocortical coherence between the left temporal cortex and the right temporal cortex was increased for the semantic lists, third word versus second. But that's actually interesting because we were interested in this relationship between the evoked response and corticocortical connectivity is that this neural activity modulation happens peaks at about 400 milliseconds. But if we look at this time course of this interaction change things using range of causality, first of all, we saw that actually it's a like feedback mechanism that then left supratemporal cortex is driving the letter string region that's earlier on in the hierarchy. What's interesting is that this effect is significant already before 200 milliseconds. So this connectivity modulation precedes the activity modulation that you see here, the baseline clinical responses. So that actually suggests that this reduced neural activity is really sort of driven by the fact that your network is operating differently, and this network operation precedes the activation modulation. So not that it's co-occurring, but it's preceding, but your language networks is in a certain state. And so this shows you that this kind of time result connectivity analysis can also be very useful, because this kind of analysis cannot be applied for naturalistic tasks that easily, but if you have cleverly create an experiment to address this kind of questions of what are the mutual relationships and processing stages in the brain. So connectivity can be also applied in this kind of manner. Then we have also used this cortical connectivity in this kind of all-to-all manner. This is our first example, how we did that. So this was sort of overt and silent speech production. So the task of the subjects was to name a picture. They did either silently or overtly, actually speaking loud a name or the verb, one or the name of the object or the action within the picture. So actually we, as a muscle behavior, muscle activity causes artifacts in the MEG signal, we were focused on the, what happens just before subjects start to speak. And actually, what we saw is that actually both increases and decreases if you compare over to silent naming. First of all, there are lots of regions that show increased mutual interactions, but there are also regions that show decreased interactions. Actually, there seems to be two components happening prior to the naming. So there's kind of, let's say, active preparation towards actually speaking aloud, but there can be also sort of like active inhibition for the silent naming, that you actually inhibit your motor performance. And interestingly, many of these regions, they can be the same analytical locations at least. We can't really say if it's the same neural populations, probably it's not the same neural populations exactly. The same functional regions in the brain are involved both this active task performance and active inhibition. This gives you the overall pattern of the representation. And then this highlights that actually we cannot directly tell with MEG if it's neural populations, but what we can see with MEG is that this active task performance and active inhibitions are taking place at different frequencies. What is like active task performance when you are preparing actually to speak aloud, you see increased cortical interactions, to like beta frequencies and both low and high beta. But for this active inhibition, we actually see that this increase within this network happens in the gamma frequencies, especially in the, say, 60 to 90 hertz range. We have also applied this type of all-to-all connectivity to other language tasks. Here's another example which shows that when you're actually reading and not speaking, in this case, words versus symbol strings. Of course, you can't really read symbol strings, but you can actually visually process them. You see wide range of differences between these cortical interactions. Here, you can see which regions have higher mutual interactions for the reading of the words, and here below, for reading of the symbols. And what you see is that for reading of words, now we get back to sort of classical view of language processing, that there's lots of regions, frontal temporal regions, also parietal regions that have higher cortical interactions for the left hemisphere for language. Whereas for the words, symbols, you have then right dominant network. And it's this sort of matches the classical view that the language processing is more on the left and visual processing on the right. But then you can also then dissociate that what are the frequencies and what's like the main finding of this study was that on the language processing, there was a lot of interactions in the alpha band, 8 to 13 hertz, whereas for this visual processing, the interactions were increased for the symbols versus words. They're primarily in the gamma band, both in the low gamma band, 30 to 45 hertz, and also in the high gamma band, 60 to 90. And actually, there were quite different components for the high gamma band. This was really the sort of, I would say, classical visual network, occipital and parietal regions. Whereas for this low gamma band, we saw also lots of long-range interactions between the frontal and parieto-occipital cortices. So these are just a couple of examples of how corticocortical connectivity can be used and applied in study of language and cognition. So we could now, hopefully, at least answer the questions of which types of data and phenomena can be investigated with corticocortical connectivity, and what kind of network descriptions can be obtained with connectivity analysis. And overall, of the whole lecture, the take-home messages are that imaging allows the estimation of neural activity and connectivity across the whole brain. Of course, you have to keep in mind that imaging measures only part of the all of the neural activity, but it measures it from all over the brain. So a second point is that the MEG has a rich temporal nature, and MEG allows also the use of multiple different types of neural measures. Third, that human cognition can be studied both via measures of neural activity, of which there are many, just auxiliary induced and phase locked activity, but also you can apply cortical peripheral and corticocortical connectivity. So when you have a question in mind, MEG necessitates that you select both the right type of experiment, right measure or phenomena to investigate, and the analysis pipeline that's suited to this. So it's a very complex field of study. Then the last point is that you can also enhance MEG only view by combining either behavioral measures, neural measures, or then you can apply additional, let's say, contrast. Typically, this investigates the difference between conditions, but I showed at least one example that if you apply, say, different subject groups, in this case, cognitive training, so that you can see if the, let's say, time course related to time cognitive training over the time course of 1 year changes how the neural processing takes place. I hope that today's lecture or this lecture is giving you some thoughts at least of the basic properties of MEG and how can they help you study human language and cognition. Thank you.